Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. The 4th of July is just a few days away. This morning we'll go with Northwest News correspondent Anna King to the tiny town of Johnson, Washington. The population stays around 50 for most of the year, but swells to over 4,000 when visitors arrive for what some call America's craziest parade. Philosopher Seth Titchener has some food for thought, not barbecued, in the second half of the show, and we'll take a quick trip to Multnomah Greyhound Park in Wood Village near Portland for a farewell celebration. The park is being demolished this week. We celebrate the life and passing of award-winning musician and Colville tribal leader, Jim Boyd. We begin with reports from the Daily Historian. Eric Bengel has been following the progress of the return of the beloved last living ferry, the Tourister No. 2. It's returning to service on the Columbia with celebration and events. Eric has the details.
The long-awaited return of Astoria's last living ferry, the Tourist No. 2, is within reach. Board members of the Astoria Ferry, a nonprofit working to bring the ferry home from Washington State, recently gave the ferry's owner, Captain Christian Lint, a $15,000 deposit. The board plans to purchase the ferry on contract. Lint skippered the ferry from Bremerton to North Lake Shipyard in Seattle to get it pressure washed and to undergo minor repairs. Lint said he plans to bring the watercraft home to Astoria sometime next month, weather permitting, just in time for the Astoria Bridge's 50th anniversary celebration. Next week, the board is holding the ferry's first fundraising event from 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. on June 29th at Street 14 Coffee. The nonprofit needs about $50,000 to pay for the shipyard work in Washington, a marine survey that will allow the board to purchase fuel, insurance, and the rest of Lint's deposit and additional costs. The event will feature historic photos of the 92-year-old vessel, and board members will be around to chat about the ferry's history. Joe Leahy, a board member, will give a short presentation at the top of every hour. Cindy Price, a board member and Astoria City Councilor, said she hopes the fundraiser draws former ferry workers. These major leaps forward follow a slow but steady year-long push to get the Tourist No. 2 back on the Columbia River. The ferry carried riders in their cars between Astoria and Washington from 1924 to 1966, when the bridge made it obsolete. Eric Bengel of the Daily Astorian for Coast Community Radio.
Eric continues with a report from the historic Liberty Theater. The theater has been busy this month hosting the 14th season of the Astoria Music Festival. The festival continues through July 2nd, but the music won't stop there. Eric tells us a new indie folk concert series is coming soon.
The Liberty Theater is launching an indie folk concert series this summer to attract a larger and more diverse audience, and in particular, the theater hopes to start bringing in a younger crowd. The Sunset Series, a six-part pilot program that may extend into next year, will feature alternative folk, alt-rock, and alt-country. A preview show featuring the bands Horse Feathers and Mandolin Orange will kick off the concerts July 13th. Then Blind Pilot, a Portland band with Astoria connections, will open the series proper on August 19th. Their show will be a release concert for the band's latest album, And Then Like Lions. Local breweries and wineries will provide beverages. The organizers plan to hold one concert every month for 6 months, but they know that scheduling conflicts may prevent that. The bands that will follow Blind Pilot will be announced soon. The Liberty recently secured $8,000 in seed money from the city's Promote Astoria Fund, but the grant will only cover about one show. Future productions will likely be funded by ticket sales and local donations. The Liberty Theater is a historic venue famous for its classical and orchestral performances. By and large, the shows appeal to the community's more senior population and patrons with highbrow tastes. The theater is currently hosting the 14th season of the Astoria Music Festival. The goal of the Sunset Series is to expand the Liberty's traditional offerings and create fond memories for generations young and old. Eric Bengel of the Daily Astorian for Coast Community Radio.
Eli Stillman from the Daily A reports from Seaside, where teams competed this week in the beach game of foot volley. It will be a demonstration sport at the 2016 Games in Rio. We had a chance to see it first.
The first ever foot volley national qualifier came to the beaches of Seaside this weekend to decide who would represent the United States in Rio de Janeiro. Foot volley is a hybrid sport which combines soccer and beach volleyball. Teams of two try to score points by getting the ball to land on their opponent's side of the net. Using your hands isn't permitted, so players put together combinations with their shoulders, feet, and heads to keep the ball in the air. For the first time ever, it will be played as a demonstration event at the Summer Olympics with 24 different countries facing off against each other. Foot volley originated on the beaches of Rio and has a strong following in parts of America like Miami and Southern California. Since the gameplay involves soccer-like touches, most of the players come from that respective background. The United States Foot Volley Association said that they picked Seaside because they wanted to plant the seed of the sport in the Pacific Northwest. With matches being televised and more hype to come from the Olympic demonstration, the sport of foot volley is poised to expand. I'm Eli Stillman of the Daily Historian for Coast Community Radio.
And while we're talking about the Olympics, we have one more sport report to round out this portion of the bridge. Fresh from their wins at the NCAA Championships, University of Oregon student athletes are excited to come back to Hayward Field for the Olympic track and field trials. Rachel McDonald has more from Eugene.
Redshirt freshman Ariana Washington won the 100 and 200 meters at the NCAAs. She says it's surreal to be competing in the trials, but she's glad she gets to do it in Eugene.
Hayward magic is Hayward magic no matter what time of year it is. I'll definitely be feeling the crowd. It'll kind of be like a little, like NCs, just a little bit more people. So I'm really excited for the crowd. I'm really excited for like all the hypeness. I know my parents will be sitting there at the finish line.
Washington had the third fastest time in the 200 at the NCs, or NCAA Championships, earlier this month. She says she got a big boost with that win. The sprinter competes this Sunday in the 100-meter dash, and then again the following Sunday in the 200. I'm Rachel McDonald in Eugene.
Lost Lake is a seasonal alpine lake just off the Santee Anton Pass Highway in Linn County. It's aptly named. Once a year, it disappears, not by evaporation or seepage. It flows away down a big hole in the lake bed. Tiffany Eckert visited the site and talked to a hydrologist about the phenomenon called Lost Lake.
Water-loving willows hug the edges of shore here. Lost Lake, at its peak, is around 79 acres. Right now, though, it's draining away. About halfway around the lake entrance, a sharp eye might spot a footpath leading out onto the grassy, muddy lake bed. Follow that, and soon, the sound of rushing water is audible. Then, there it is, the hole. Dave Kretzing has a pretty good grasp on the mystery of Lost Lake. He's a retired hydrologist with the U.S. Forest Service, and he's spent years thinking about what happens here and why.
Whether it's a lava tube or whether it just is a sinkhole into a buried channel, we don't know unless we did some kind of seismic investigation. Well, this hole is around 7 to 8 feet in diameter. It's about 6 feet deep. It's got rubble in the bottom. Well, the water is passing through the hole, and it's passing underneath lava into a buried channel of a tributary of the Mackenzie River.
Kretzing says geologists believe the Mackenzie was formed in the Pleistocene era. More than 2,000 years ago, the Sand Lake volcanoes began to erupt. The cones buried one of these ancestral channels, creating an underground river.
And these eruptions blocked the channel and buried it, and created Lost Lake. And of course, that ancestral channel still existed. It was just buried, not destroyed. And so we believe the water is flowing through this hole in the bottom of the lake, down and accessing that original channel and flowing on downward, eventually coming out at Clear Lake.
The hydrologist Kretzing says it's easy to think of Lost Lake as a sink with a drain that isn't completely closed. When you turn the tap on full strength, it fills up. If you turn the tap down enough, the water starts to empty down the drain. In the rainy wintertime, when stream flows are high, Lost Lake fills. When rainfall and stream flows drop during summer months, the amount going in becomes less than the capacity of the hole to drain the water. So the lake drains fast.
It was reported to us in 2003, in fact, at that time, we went up and found a gentleman with his two grandchildren frantically shoveling material and rocks in to block the hole to save the fish. We didn't really want them to do that, but their hearts were in the right place.
This is an interesting natural phenomenon, and that piques curiosity. Kretzing hopes that when people come here to look at Lost Lake, they enjoy it and leave it as they found it. I'm Tiffany Eckert reporting from Lost Lake on the Santiam Pass.
The historic Multnomah Greyhound Park near Portland invited the public to a farewell celebration this week before its complete demolition in early July. Correspondent Mira Powell was there and has the report.
The Greyhound Park farewell celebration was hosted by the Grand Ronde Tribe and the City of Wood Village, who are collaborating together to decide the land's future. The project's media consultant, Nancy Hamilton, spoke about a potential option.
There were several scenarios that were presented to the community, one of which was a hotel entertainment venue focus, perhaps with some housing or some additional retail, and that was the clear favorite in the room.
The Grand Ronde Tribe also owns Spirit Mountain Casino, located about 30 miles west of Salem. The tribe says the project will have some affiliation with the casino, but didn't specify if it would include any gambling. The Greyhound racetrack has been vacant since 2004 and opened in 1957. I'm Mira Powell in Portland.
We're one together, we're family, the Colville Reservation, and far away from Switzerland, my heart and soul.
Members of the Colville tribe and music fans are mourning the death of award-winning musician Jim Boyd this month. Boyd collaborated with author Sherman Alexie on the soundtrack for the 1988 film Smoke Signals. He was a seven-time award winner of the Native American Music Awards and a Lifetime Achievement Award recipient. He served as tribal elder and, until his death 2 weeks ago, chaired the Colville tribe's business council. Steve Jackson of Spokane Public Radio talked with Boyd 2 years ago. We have that interview.
The Native American musician and chairman of the Colville Confederated Tribes died from what family members call natural causes. Jim Boyd was 60 years old. Boyd was a recording artist with several releases to his credit, including contributing songs to the soundtrack from the 1998 film Smoke Signals. Boyd told us a couple of years ago he began playing music at a very early age.
You know, I remember being 4 years old and being this, I was just obsessed with music even then. I remember, and I had these little plastic instruments, and those were my, you know, those were my toys. Nobody could mess with them, you know. And so basically it was, I mean, I started then, and then I remember being like in, we lived on and off the reservation. My dad was in the Air Force for 20 years, so we would live a couple of years on an Air Force base, a couple of years on the res. We'd just kind of go back and forth with that. And I remember trying to build my own drum set, like in around fourth grade or something like that, out of cardboard.
Jim Boyd played in cover bands as a lead guitar player for several years and didn't start to write his own material until his 30s.
Well, I quit drinking and everything else, you know, like 23 years ago. And during that time, I got a couple, you know, degree from commercial music and jazz studies there. And then I ended up getting a small business management degree from the Falls. And so during that time, I kind of went through a lot for a few years there, and then I just decided to go ahead and I just started writing these songs, and a lot of them were issue-oriented songs, or, you know, I just different things that I'd never even thought about before.
At one point, Boyd teamed up with Native American writer Sherman Alexie and wrote songs together with him. Boyd said he never wanted to be stereotyped as one specific musical genre because of his heritage.
I did more traditional stuff. I did from even stick game stuff, which is a game we play on the reservations, mm-hmm. you know, locally. And I did, but a lot of it was kind of more folkish, folk rockish. And then I did rock. I've got 14 albums out, and they're all totally different from each other, you know. And that's the problem I figured out on my own label, was that's why they want me to do one type of music, so they can put it in this slot in the stores, you know. And so when, you know, I worked with Sherman Alexie on Reservation Blues, and so we did some of the songs that were in the Smoke Signal soundtrack, mm-hmm. and the Reservation Blues it's not blues. So that's what I noticed, is the record stores would put it in the blues category there, but it's not blues. You know, it's actually more focused.
In 2014, Jim Boyd received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Native American Music Awards. Boyd was a member of the Arrow Lakes Band, one of the 12 tribes that make up the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation.
I'm a Colville tribe of Indian, and I come from Michelin, from the lakes band by the river, across the border we begin. And my people fish the waters till the Columbia turned to lake, and Grand Coulee took the salmon, and my people's heart did break.
I'm Steve Jackson reporting.
The 4th of July is just around the corner. In the tiny wheat farming town of Johnson, Washington, population 50, they're getting ready for the 50th year of what some call America's craziest parade. The parade starts at 10 sharp on the 4th of July, and every summer around 4,000 people from across the country flock there to see it. Correspondent Anna King has our story.
Every summer, around 4,000 people from across the country flock to Johnson, population 50. The crop duster tips his wings at 10 a.m. over a stretch of road with a schoolhouse on one end and a grain elevator on the other, and the parade starts. Four farm-raised sisters are the founders and matriarchs. Here's one of them, Claire. She's manning the inspection station at the start of the parade route back in 2009.
Good morning, NPR. We're in Johnson, Washington, the beautiful home of the 4th of July parade. Yeah!
Claire started the parade with her sisters and one brother on the 4th of July 50 years ago. Her older sister Chris was grown, 18, but still, she says, they were all whining at their mother over breakfast.
There's nothing to do. And mother said, why don't you have a parade? You could dress up as the spirit of 76. So that was a good plan because there were no other options on the table.
By 8 a.m., Chris had found a pair of cymbals. Another sister made a drum out of an ice cream container. And their other sister played flute in the school band, so
she knew how to play Yankee Doodle. And Drew carried a flag.
The siblings made a route to the neighbors at several nearby farms, waking some of them up that morning. About the third year, a couple of neighbors came with lawn chairs to watch the children march down Johnson Road. From the start, this has been children's play. And even though they're grown up now, with grandchildren, they like to keep the mischief and fun. Like the sisters' Johnson Security Inspection Station, all teams must pass it before parading on down the road. One year, they found a giant roll of stickers at Goodwill. They stuck one to each person, car, or horse that passed. The sticker said, slightly imperfect.
Oh, quality control.
This is a quality inspection
now,
station.
I know this hurts because this is exactly opposite of what your mother's been saying all these years, but you are slightly imperfect.
Now the parade stretches about a half a mile down Johnson Road, and the paraders double back around, so everyone claps twice for each act, from bagpipers to kids on their trikes. Two sides of the founding family always try to one-up each other. They each pack a theme and keep it secret until the last second. Like the Beach Boys versus a synchronized lawn mowing team. Past parades have paid tribute to family members who've died, the women's mother and each of their two brothers. For the 50th year, there'll be gold everywhere. Matching shirts, a painted bus, and bling. Chris says, come see it if you like, or
don't have to come to our parade. There's still a lot of time to start your own parade. All you need is a street and a group of kids and the 4th of July.
I'm Anna King, outside of Johnson, Washington.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. Bye. Bye, guys.
You're listening to The Bridge. Seth Titchener is an educator and a philosopher for the 21st century. His nonprofit organization, Philosopherian, hosts the Wit and Wisdom series at the Fort George Lovell Showroom and can be found on Facebook. I asked Seth to share some wisdom with us as we celebrate our nation's birthday.
All we've been given by those who came before. The dream.
Soon we will be celebrating the 4th of July, or more specifically, we will celebrate the signing of the Declaration of Independence and the Enlightenment ideals of democracy which it harbingered, notably the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These rights were taken by Thomas Jefferson, the text's principal author, to be self-evident truths that were inseparable from human dignity. Indeed, Jefferson went so far as to say, just as the philosophers John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau did before him, that the legitimacy of any government was grounded in securing these rights in civil society by and through the consent of those persons governed. We also can look back on the writing of this text now and see the hypocrisies and contradictions that existed between the ideals that Jefferson gave voice to and the political and cultural realities within which that voice spoke. The stain of slavery and racism, the political exclusion and social subjugation of women, the squalor of poverty, the disenfranchisement of minorities, and the genocide of indigenous peoples, to name but a few. These problems run deep for us, still bedeviling us today in one fashion or another, 240 years after the Declaration of Independence was written. And yet, even with these realities, the ideals of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as rights continued on and continue on today. They call on us to push back against these iniquities around us and in so doing push us forward on the path of progress, however stumbling and wayward that path may be. In our civil life as Americans, the ideals put forth in the Declaration of Independence form a kind of secular spirituality and act as both a catalyst and a horizon for the better angels of our nature, even as we fail to ever fully grasp them. But why these ideals? Noble as they are, what sets them apart from other ideals we can and sometimes do hold up for ourselves? The answer, I think, is that these ideals of the inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness don't stand on their own. They are reflections and expressions of a deeper ideal, and one that is very much at the heart of American identity. It is the notion that civil society can, when done rightly, be a crucible for human freedom itself. Recognizing this distinction is important because without it, we are likely to misunderstand and misuse our right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Human freedom is more than the three great civil rights articulated in the Declaration of Independence. It refers to the florid fullness of being what we may be in the stature and manner of being ourselves. It is the realization, as it were, of ourselves as ourselves. And in this, freedom is the quintessence of these three civil rights. Without human freedom, each of them is, for lack of a better way of putting it, hollow. Life without freedom becomes listless drudgery at best. Liberty without freedom becomes chaotic. The pursuit of happiness without freedom becomes an aimless and self-confounding hedonism. It's only when these three civil rights abide in freedom, the true inner freedom that civil society may hopefully be a forge for, that they bear fruit in the American experiment and in the human endeavor generally. It's easy to lose sight of just how significant freedom is for us. It's easy to take it for granted, to see it as a nuisance, or even a threat. But it is something that must be protected, investigated, cultivated, and celebrated in civil society for the sake of civil society. There are, doubtless, always challenges around the authentic embrace of freedom. But embrace it we must, lest our shortcomings get the best of us, as they have time and again. This is why civil society is a crucible for human freedom, a vessel to forge and meld with effort and skill. Let's take this holiday to remember and celebrate that.
All we've been given by those who came before. the dream of a nation where freedom would endure. The working prayers of centuries have brought us to this day. What shall be our legacy? What will our children say? Let them say of me, I was one who believed in sharing the blessings I received. Let me know in my heart when my days are through. America,
that's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part or just want to hear it again, it is available as a podcast on our website at coastalradio.org. I'm Kate Brister. On behalf of the board, staff, and volunteers of Coast Community Radio, we wish you a very joyful and thoughtful 4th of July wherever you are. Thank you for listening, and join us next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.